Hi folks, a little bit of housekeeping before we start the podcast. This conversation was recorded a few days ago with UUP member and LGBT activist Michael Palmer. Obviously, we've seen the burning effigies and what has happened on the bonfires, but you know, it's a lot more nuanced than that, and it's not representative of loyalist unionism as a whole. So I'd ask you to have a listen. Michael has a really great nuanced view of how his community is represented and how they feel about their place in both the union and in the conversations that are beginning to happen. Please support this podcast. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Anything you do, anything you can help, just chip in. That'd be really, really appreciated. Thanks for the support and enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and I'm still solo, folks. Apparently, the other fella has decided that he's fit enough to come home, but he's not fit enough to do any work yet. But nonetheless, we will soldier on. And this is a podcast that I've been looking forward to now for a while. It's one of those social media introduces you to all sorts of characters. And my net is cast wide when it comes to some of these things. And I've been watching Michael Palmer on social media for a while. Michael is he's a degree in politics from Ulster University. He's written his PhD on unionism, loyalism, a dissertation on unionism, loyalism. He's contributed to the likes of the newsletter and, of course, Slugger O'Toole. And you are also a UUP member and activist. Michael, not only that, I'm going to put it in it this way, also a member, proud member of the LGBT community. It's great to talk to you finally.
Oh, yeah. So good evening. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's it'd be remiss not to mention the meltdown in 10 Downing Street that's currently occurring as we're talking now. You are a student of politics and a student of UK politics in general. Can you just give me how it looks like from the outside, maybe from through that prism of loyalist unionism? Because I put it to you, no other community has been more let down in a way that by this current administration than yours.
Yes, I mean, I was watching it all last night. It's things are happening so fast. Out of all the governments I've seen collapse, this one's collapsing like all around. It's all over the place. And probably unlike previous prime ministers, who sort of knew when to go. Boris doesn't know when to go. That's kind of the problem. There is the UK side of things, and obviously the UK does need to get an effective government in place, a stable government in place, but there's then the devolved side to how that works out for Scotland, Wales, and even here in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, believe it or not, we have been let down by that government, but we're also dependent on that government to reach a solution, because we need a solution and a protocol really to get Stormont back. That's what the DUP has said. So we don't know where it's all going to end. There is a protocol bill going through Parliament at the moment, but you know, if there's not even a government place, if we don't even know if the Tories are going to be in power, or if there's going to be a general election, that sends all that away, and we could end up with another assembly election this year. Yeah, that's very possible.
We are on the clock for another assembly election. Is the truth of that, isn't it? Let's be honest here. It's not getting there, and we'll get into it in a bit way about making Stormont work. But I just conscious of in terms of how the North is always an afterthought when it comes to events on especially in Westminster and particularly in Number 10. It must be a huge frustration for you as a member of a community who, you know, by definition, this is who you are loyal to the union. And they are the people who are saying, look, we're just going to plow on and have these, or you have to, and again, this is not to be so seedy about it. I don't like that. But these are sex scandals as well. It couldn't be more pathetic than it was. And I don't want to make light of it. Two men were sexually harassed, and that's not good enough. That's not acceptable. But when you hear it, it must be a huge frustration.
I mean, the Tories have let down unionism just about every single time I can think of it. But unfortunately, that is just the way it is. Unionism for me has always been about being committed to the union, regardless of whether it's Labour or Tories in power. Sadly, we are often let down. And yes, we are often loyal to that union. We're loyal to it largely for historical reasons, cultural reasons, even geography, and also social reasons as well. We just don't identify the Republic of Ireland. So we find unionism is really what works for us. But obviously, we have to adapt unionism to obviously 2022. The union is changing, of course, and we do need to sort of adapt to modern times and try to maintain the union through all of the everything that you're seeing now. You know, it's just chaos, really.
Well, like you actually wrote a letter to the DUP and asked them to come to Belfast Pride, and one of the sentences where you finished it was where you basically said to them that the future of unionism and the union can hinge upon LGBT support, and that speaks to me when we'll talk about culture, we'll talk about those issues, but that also speaks to me about a evolution within unionism, because, like, you know, you grew up as a young gay man from a unionist community. I don't want to do the whole, you know, we could have the music fade in and we can say, come on, Michael, tell us what it was like, but do, you know, give us a sense of what that was like and how you feel now the place for the LGBT community is as a person who's quite vocal and upfront and actually say, you know, I see you on social media. It seems very welcoming in many ways.
So I suppose, yes, I sort of got into politics back when I was a teenager. That was late 2000s or so. And I remember at the time all sorts of comments being made by the DUP. You know, there was the famous Irish Robson comments. There was all sorts of comments. I mean, there's a whole history of it. So obviously as a teenager, it was very hard for me to see that because these are supposed to be people that are on my side. They're the good guys. And there's then Sinn Féin on the opposite side who are the bad guys from a unionist point of view. And yet they're the ones who are pro-LGBT. So I was a bit confused when I was a teenager, to be quite honest. So I suppose my views adapted. I mean, obviously, I evolved. Obviously, there's more to politics than LGBT issues. So I do come from a unionist background. I do hold very much unionist beliefs. So the DUP / UUP would represent me more in terms of unionism. And obviously, that's where I sort of identify with. And obviously, Sinn Féin, yes, they're considered pro-LGBT, but they're, you know, it is a Republican Party, the one of United Ireland. There's also the history of Sinn Féin. But certainly, growing up as a gay unionist was pretty tough. And I joined the UUP in 2013 in an attempt to try and change that. And largely, it's those internal discussions which I had within the UUP and just keep on pushing.
Because I spoke to a trans woman earlier, a fascinating conversation about a trans woman who set up a clinic in rural Washington to help with transition surgeries. And she spoke about, you know, knowing from a young age that she needed to transition, but also maintaining a career where she identified as a male in her workplace, but wasn't out there, but was it so even now, you know, that's, we see all the boiling up of culture wars and all of this stuff now. But when you were involved in politics first, did you just kind of keep that to yourself, that your sexuality was something that you knew at the time was going to be problematic for some people you were actually actively participating in politics with?
Yes, so I sort of like to follow myself as openly closet. So way back when I joined, I mean, I kept that to myself, obviously. And obviously, you can only do that for so long because people start to wonder, well, why isn't he married? And, you know, he doesn't show any interest in women and all that stuff. So you can only do that for so long. And obviously, it's tiring on me because I, of course, have to come up with all sorts of reasons as to why I'm not married and all sorts of reasons as to why, you know, for example, why you're at a gay bar, why you're attending Pride, all that stuff. So, I eventually came out as I went along. And obviously, the UUP before, some years ago, it wouldn't have really attended Pride. I would have attended Pride, obviously. And it's sort of a conscience party, so it's that type of view. But nowadays, the UUP, thankfully, is attending Pride. My leader, Doug Beattie, put forward a motion to ban conversion therapy in Northern Ireland. So that was good. That was something I also had gone on about in the UUP for years. So it was good to finally see UUP MLA to put that forward. And obviously, my own leader's trying to make those changes within unionism. So he's trying to, you know, bring forward young people, bring forward women, bring forward LGBT. So he is trying to, you know, make unionism more inclusive and to be more representative of society.
Yeah, I think, you've struck on something there that brings the conversation on. Is that space within unionism? Because I know, ultimately, you consider yourself a British citizen standing on British soil. And that should not be controversial to say. That should be just, these are so, but when we come down to it now, the way things are evolving, particularly in the Republic, we have made a we have made so many characterizations about your community that we could, like, you know, the idea that we're going to even sit down and have these conversations to some people can be anathema, and older people just misinformed. So you're talking about the UUP trying to find a space. Tell me what the pitch is to the people in Northern Ireland to stay within the union, because that's one thing that I always get. They always want this idea of saying, well, actually, we just have to make things better here. And I think that is a crucial issue, because we can talk about bonfires and flags and marches and parades and murals and all of those things. And they can, you know, they can cause problems throughout all communities. But we should be really talking about housing, healthcare, reproductive choices, all of these things that matter to people. How do you get things going, particularly in a dysfunctional democratic union that is currently dormant?
So basically the benefits of the union, or?
Yeah. Please tell me why you think if I was in Belfast, why I should be thinking, actually, you know what, we can actually make this place better without the idea of running towards a border poll, which is all the rage.
Yeah, so basically the union for me is, first of all, we've got the NHS, so you don't have to pay for healthcare. You also have, we're part of one of the largest economies in the world. It's higher than Republic of Ireland. You've also got the fact that the Republicans, Sinn Féin is the largest party. It's obviously trying to make the case for United Ireland. The problem of that is that the history of that party, and even today, with its continued glorification of terrorism, basically, that would be very problematic for the Unions Committee and probably for the other community. And I've never seen from Sinn Féin any concrete plans for United Ireland. They keep calling for it, but I just don't see anything there. Like, how are they going to deal with, for example, healthcare? How are they going to deal with, I don't know, pensions, the economy? And, of course, how are you going to deal with unionism? Because unionism would be a huge problem in United Ireland. Because
I think there's an opportunity in that problem. Because I think you call it a problem. I think unionism has seen a shrinking of social mobility, where we've seen, you know, less educational attainment and lower income standards than over generations in parts of unionism. And in a shared Ireland, whether we go down the route of a border poll or we start to have more cooperation or whatever way we do it, I think there's a huge role for the unionist community that can actually thrive. And I just don't think that vision has been actually I agree with you. It hasn't been painted out correctly from a nationalist perspective, because sometimes, and I will say this and I'll get in trouble with other people, and I don't care, there's too much glorification of the past and there's too much triumphalism of the present. We don't need that. We need to move to how we do these things. Because regardless of whether we go down the route that you talk about with strengthening the union, or we move towards a more cooperative Ireland, it has to actually happen. It's better to happen in a cooperative way than in the other. And this is just simply, I think when we where we're talking about problems, there are opportunities, Michael. Do people not? Are people willing to have those conversations? Because I do find when I speak to people, they say, you know, I spoke to Colin Harvey, and Colin would say, well, I don't expect that people will join us around the table to talk about this because they don't want to. And it's a hard, you can't square that circle.
Yeah, it's a very difficult circle to square, because unionism actually has become more hardened in Northern Ireland in recent times. Lawlessness in particular has largely rejected the Good Friday Agreement. And I'll be honest, I mean, in places like Newton Ars, you know, majority towns and all that, there's just no appetite for United Ireland. There's no appetite of even accepting it. It's just not something they want to be part of. It's not something that they want to discuss. And that's largely why unionism doesn't discuss it, because we would say, well, why would we want to discuss our, you know, breaking up of the union, basically? So certainly, though, I mean, if United Ireland happened, obviously, as I'm a Democrat, I'd probably have to accept it, but certainly I would be wanting to very much change things like the flag, very much change, you know, everything about that state. And Republicans have even told me, you know, in terms of the flag, oh, there's no need to change the flag, Michael, it already represents you. And the answer is it doesn't. You know, for unionists, we would see that flag as representing, you know, associate of the IRA, whether that's right or wrong. That is how unions up here in Northern Ireland would see that, even though it is the Irish national flag, but it is associated, it is on, you know, Coffin's IRA.
Again, these are... you gotta remember, I told you before we came on air, I'm kind of a lefty who believes in kind of open borders and so I think all of those things, those accoutrements and things that I think we can get past those. I mean, I once suggested that we just replace it. We have a joint national anthem of a song by the Divine Comedy. Okay. I didn't care what the anthem was as long as it was something we could all get behind. Nonetheless, I do think it's important you point out that unionism has hardened. The TUV has given a space there that has actually meant the DUP must actually drag to the right. Well, we've seen this in other jurisdictions. Like, we only have to look at what's happened with Macron in the last couple of weeks, where he's, you know, I'm the political center, and yet he's forming governments with Marine Le Pen's organization and her group. So we see that where it's dragging. But that doesn't mean that I put it to you that within your community that people actually should stop caring about housing, healthcare, education, jobs, and unfortunately they don't get talked about enough, and that's a failure of politics.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd be pro-devolution, so I'm actually probably in the minority, actually, in a way. I actually want Stormont to work. I want devolution. I actually want to work together with nationalists and Republicans, but unfortunately, I mean, at the moment in Northern Ireland politics, you've got the protocol, which is just, it's completely dominated debate. It's taken over all those debates. So we're not discussing things like the health service, which we can't discuss because we can't have a multi-year budget at the moment. There is no government. So things like the protocol have just taken over. We're now going into, obviously, it's the 12th of July next week, and there's obviously the usual debates about bonfires and, you know, all that.
Now, hang on. I do think these bonfires are very OTT. Like, they are very, I don't like seeing, you said the Irish flag represents one thing to you. I don't like seeing the Irish flag burning on those bonfires at all. And I don't like seeing pictures of individuals burning on these bonfires. And I also look at them as someone who's concerned about climate action and go, what the hell are we doing here? You know?
I think on bonfires, definitely, there needs to be safety. So absolutely, any bonfires need to be safe, needs to be done properly. And yes, I agree. Flag, the tricolor shouldn't be burned, or effigies or people. That's not right. I don't agree with that. I don't actually go to bonfires anyway. It's just never reason.
I know people who do and say that they're brilliant family occasions for some people, where in the better organized ones where there's a bit of music and people having fun. And as you say, security done. I know they go and enjoy some of these things. So there's a space for that, but there's not a space for the incitement that is some of these images that we see year on year. And, you know, it does seem that they're only getting bloody bigger. I mean, I saw one earlier, and I think I posted the comments in Johnny Ronan, who wanted to build a 20-story thing down on the docks in Dublin, would be envious of this thing. You know, they're quite extraordinary feats. But nonetheless, I don't want to get sidetracked into bonfires and that. I do want to ask you. And I think it's a fair question. You brought up the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, and when we were talking, you mentioned that, you know, that unionism thinks it's redundant. Effectively, I put it to you that it's only redundant because it sat on a bloody shelf. It was never actually implemented, so there was no peace dividend. It was just we have this document now, and we'll more or less pretend that's fixed everything, and we haven't gone through the processes of actually doing that. Should we only see, was it last week where they talked about the schools, the influence of Catholic and Protestant ethos in schools has to be challenged? Now, we have a huge problem in the South with the Catholic Church dominating much of our primary school, like they own them. But like, we see the schools are still divided majority in the North, and we have all of these issues. None of that has played out, and it's a lack of implementation. And again, this isn't to you, Michael. The Irish government is also culpable because they were co-signatories to this. We can't just say blame people up north and people in Westminster. We were signatories to this. We haven't helped actually promote the benefits of what was supposed to be a game changer of an agreement.
Yes, I mean, I'm actually pro-agreement, and I would still be pro-agreement, which again, I'm probably in the minority within unionism and that, but certainly the Good Friday Agreement, it was a signed text. It was an agreement between UUP, SDLP, and I suppose those two parties always thought they'd be in power until DUP and Sinn Féin came along. I think within unionism, it was just never properly sold. It was never properly accepted. Within unionism, we always tend to see, you know, the dark side of things rather than the good side of things. I do personally think, though, the Good Friday Agreement does need reformed. You know, there's all sorts of things that need to be looked at.
Give me, if I said to you, here's a pen, cross out a couple of things and throw in a couple of things, what would you like to do?
So the first thing that needs to go is mandatory coalitions. This idea that one party, for whatever reason, can collapse the whole thing and that's it, that needs to go. We need to have more effective government. So I'm in favour of looking at things which, you know, if you can get a more effective government that can make decisions instead of us always being held up by, you know, whether it's a petition of concern or whether it's some other cross-committee mechanism. But in saying that, nowadays, with unionism being in the minority within the Assembly, there's probably going to be less appetite for that.
Yeah. Sam McElwain always makes the point it should never have been First Minister, Deputy First Minister. It should always have been a joint thing. And by not doing that, they've made a rod to their own back now, unfortunately. And that's something that, like, but again, that comes back to where we're talking about. You know, these should be simple things to overcome. They really should be simple things. Why do we complicate them?
I think with Sinn Féin, so in the whole Sinn Féin First Minister thing, my generation probably, honestly, we're probably more accepting of it, but the older generations are, it's very much a no-no because, again, they remember the troubles, they remember what happened. So for them, it's a very big no. That's why the DUP are scared of going into government with Sinn Féin as, you know, with them as First Minister. Some of the solutions to that is some people would say, well, why don't the unionist parties join together so you can have the unionist parties all together? But of course, unionist unions and everything. I think it's important to point out that although the DUP is the second largest party, the unionist designation overall is actually the largest. Mm-hmm. So under the Good Friday Agreement, we would actually be entitled to the First Minister position. But of course, that changed in St. Andrews, where it's now the largest party that gets it.
So. Yeah, but again, because you've outlined it yourself, unionism is a broad church. Not everybody would be as close to the TUV as they would be to, say, perhaps the Alliance Party. You know, there's people who are closer in different areas where they would have different views on things. And, you know, some of the stuff after last election was the Alliance Party's result overstated. I think it was kind of they had a good day. It wasn't, you know, they didn't kick down the door and come true. But there's a broad church within unionism. And I mean, you've actually written about it yourself that we shouldn't have one type of unionism, one party in unionism. You've said this yourself that it's a danger to actually, it should be healthy to have a diversity of views within that. But ultimately, you know, we still want people, especially in the South, we go, oh, sure, they'll just vote orange or green. And that's the end of that. And but you mentioned your generation, that's not necessarily the case. So you're within the tent trying to kick for change within. There are others who are outside the tent saying, join us out here. Call it for me. Are we just going to see this play out and another election within a couple of months?
It's a very good question. Obviously, with what's happening in Westminster at the moment, I don't really know what's going to happen. Another election could happen, yes. Personally, I think really we've had enough elections for the time being. I prefer to just get the government back and try and deliver on those issues that we talked about, healthcare, education, and just try and get things moving again, trying to get some optimism. People like me, you know, we're tired of talking about the protocol and Brexit. Let's just talk about other things personally, you know.
But the protocol itself, I get why people can, you know, why they can say it changes their relationship with their identity. I can completely understand that. But there are also a lot of stuff showing that there are economic benefits to parts of it. You can have the best of both worlds in some ways. And if you adapt quicker, you can thrive faster. Do you think it's a mis-selling issue rather than there is a grounds? I think the EU could actually make changes. I do agree that the EU could actually soften some of the things. And I think they should, because if they did, I think the opportunity there for Northern Ireland and the entirety of the island, by the way, is so much more potential, because you will literally have the best of both worlds. I don't want you to become tax haven Dublin. I mean, yesterday we had our tax receipts are through the roof because we're such a successful multinational corporation hub. And I kind of push back on that, going, well, that's not sustainable because some of that is based on tax avoidance elsewhere. But nonetheless, you see parts of Belfast are thriving now, particularly around the business and tech community and areas of that are already seeing the benefits of actually having access to the single market while maintaining access to the union. Is it mis-selling? Should people be actually going around saying, actually, guys, we could turn this to our advantage here.
So for the protocol, you get contradictory views. I mean, as my own leader has said, it's either a feast or famine. Some people benefit, some people don't.
Yeah.
For us as units, we want legitimate access, a quality of provision across all of the UK. At the moment, we're not really getting that. And we've also got things like, you know, checks on goods and, you know, things like that. So I think the concerns of unionism are perfectly legitimate. The protocol is definitely an issue. As you say, the EU could soften its stance, but it won't, because that's politics between the EU.
I think the EU would have softened its stance a little bit more if they hadn't run off and said, oh, by the way, we're not talking to you, and here's this new bill we're doing. You know, they did delay for something like 6 weeks of coming to the table. And I do, because I had heard from Brussels that there was mood music about the EU softening some of the things. And I just think, again, but that wouldn't have played well in Westminster, because they didn't care so much about the union other than making Boris look strong. It's always a political choice there. Him trying to look strong by kicking the EU because there was some sort of sex scandal about him or something. And our party gate was flaring up again. The reports into what he got up to. And so the union and the protocol, unfortunately, have become a useful tool in many ways. And, you know, I admire the fact that you maintain this kind of this wanting it to be better, and this idea that they don't seem to bloody care, Michael. The lads in Westminster don't seem to give two shits.
Sadly, they don't, and I'd agree with that. But I think in terms of the whole protocol, I mean, the problem is Boris wanted to get Brexit done. He got Brexit done for English Tories. He certainly didn't get it done for Northern Ireland Unionism. He never got the consent of Northern Ireland Unionism. Had he got the consent of Northern Ireland Unionism, it might not be in this situation.
Well, he lied to Northern Ireland Unionism. He came over and he lied and he said, I will never do this, that, and the other. And then he went back and said to the EU, I'll do this, that, and the other. He did lie.
Sadly, yes. And the thing for me is I never trusted Boris in the first place. I never liked the guy anyway. So he certainly didn't betray me, because I wouldn't trust the guy. I never have. And, you know, the sooner he's gone, the better, really, in my view. But obviously, I'd prefer to get the protocol sorted. Certainly for me, though, it was all about getting Brexit done. And unionism was not involved. And certainly, I think unionism has had to try and harden to try and get that through to the government, that they do need to sort this protocol out. And then we can thankfully get back to government and just get on with things again, you know.
Look, by the time we finish this podcast, I kind of estimate that he's going to be gone anyway. If not, he's probably holding on to the furnishings and being pulled off and out. But nonetheless, can I ask you a question that's kind of, I understand the reticence to engage with the idea of United Ireland. I understand that people won't come to the table because that's not who they see themselves as. But you've also said you're a Democrat. You've also said that, you know, these are the means. Within the mechanics of Stormont itself, if that was functioning, if that was working, if you saw new proposals around housing, health, even climate action. I mean, I know climate action bills passed just before Stormont collapsed the last time, you know, and all of these things get through. Do you think then with a cross-border thing, there would be more thing to say, well, actually, This place can work. It doesn't need to be this or doesn't need to be that. It can work.
In terms of Northern Ireland,
I made a joke once that if we had a United Ireland and they gave independent rule in Belfast, my big fear is that Cork would want to secede, and I say let them off. We don't want them. But you know, like there are always sort of federal ideas. There's all sorts of ideas for certain things like that maybe make a process something that can be workable, and these are conversations that should happen. But Northern Ireland doesn't bloody work. That Parliament hasn't worked.
Well, in my view, Northern Ireland does work. It's not working maybe right now the way we want it to, but it does work, and we will make it work. But I think within the United Ireland thing, I mean, a border poll has not even been called, so we're jumping to conclusions before. Yeah. You know, you'd have to actually win the border poll first. And even within, say, the Catholic community, even amongst some moderate nationalists, they actually don't want a United Ireland yet. They don't think it's the right time. And if you did have United Ireland, there'll probably be trouble. There'll be lawless who'd be, you know, going to get up to things. So, I mean, I personally don't want to unite Ireland ever. Personally, I wouldn't be. I'd be ideologically committed to the union, so I couldn't be persuaded of it anyway. So.
I wouldn't ask you to. I would just say that you respected the will of the people should it come to that vote. One other question, I suppose, that's important is the idea that we do have to put a hard border on the island of Ireland. What do you think of that personally?
So I don't want any borders north or south, east or west. So for me, I prefer no border north, south, east or west.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm glad because the idea we should not be going backwards. But unfortunately, we see across the world that a lot of progress is not always forward. Like we see what's happened with Roe versus Wade. We see what's happened with some of the rights and how things are being peeled back. We don't want to go back. And we certainly don't want to have to endure the issues like that again. Look, I won't delay any further, but I will ask you, if you were to, like, within the next few months, we're probably facing a new election instalment, or we'll get it running. Do you believe that within unionism, they understand that actually the onus is to forget about, and this goes for nationalist community as well, forget about flags and marches and protests. We need to get back to the issues here. We can't wait for, like, you mentioned the NHS. It's great you have the NHS. We don't have an NHS here. Yet Northern Ireland has the highest waiting lists in all of the UK. So it's got the NHS, but it's not exactly knocking it out of the park either.
I think for me anyway, there's no overall politics, but there's no overall society. Society up here has moved on. That is the truth. And I mean, I saw her at Dublin Pride, and Dublin Pride I think is brilliant. I actually wanted to go to it, but unfortunately I couldn't find anyone to go with. So I thought Dublin Pride was brilliant.
Well, next time you want to come, just drop me a text and we'll go and make it. Honest to God, like it's a fabulous day out, you know?
There's mixing. I mean, I have Republican friends. I've dated Republicans, you know, so society up here has moved on, and you know it's only the politics. And certainly, say for Belfast Pride, it's on Saturday, the 30th of July. You're going to have unionists and nationalists together under a rainbow flag. So I think for me that speaks quite loudly as to where Northern Ireland's going. So I'm quite positive for the future of Northern Ireland. We just have a few bumps along the way that we need to sort out.
those bumps are going to be pretty bumpy, Michael. But I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me this evening. I know you've been a little bit under the weather, so it's not great. People can find you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
Commander MP.
Yeah, now there you go, guys. There you go. See, he pretended he was a lovely guy, but there you go.
Comes from a video game, Command and Conquer.
Yeah. Look, Michael Palmer, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time. Listen, folks, we have we've two more podcasts coming. I don't know if you saw during the week the report from the SRI on children living at home longer. Basically, they're not children, they're adults, and they're being delayed the right to housing because it's so difficult to get bloody housing. That SRI report, one of the economists who contributed to that is joining us to cover that. And John Harris from The Guardian is going to talk Boris on how things are melting down. So we get John on, he talks a bit of politics, and I ask him about music. That's where it is, that conversation goes. You know how it is. Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.